Hey folks, this is To Know the Land, broadcasting from the Treaty Territories of the Mississauga of the Credit on 93.3 FM at the University of Guelph. Maybe you're listening through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to your podcasts. It's a show about our connections with the land base, how we interact with the land, how we learn about the land, how we defend the land. And for today's show, I got a wonderful experience. I got to go visit a garden that's been planted by two artists in Guelph, Lisa Hermer and Christina Kingsbury. And it's a beautiful garden, a garden planted for moths, a garden planted for other species, not the human world, but the more than human world. Or maybe that reciprocal quality that we share, that space that we share. And for me, it's just so beautiful. It's so amazing to be creating spaces with the intention of relationality between species. I've hosted other people on the show before where that's their work, that's their intention, that's their goals. But I like this one a lot because this feels very replicable. It feels very, we can build more of these spaces. We can transform places into places that are really tangibly reciprocal and giving back. If only on a small scale, if only we have so much space. And this garden does that. It's a beautiful thing. So I'll let Lisa and Christina introduce the project and you'll hear all about it. Can you all introduce yourselves and the place where we're at?
Sure. I'm Christina Kingsbury. I'm an artist and an educator and a very grateful collaborator, and we're here today at our project Moth Garden, which is an art project and a garden for moths.
And I am Lisa Hermer. I am also an artist and also a grateful collaborator with Christina on this garden project.
Sadly, many folks don't get to see this. Can you describe where we're sitting?
Sure. So we're sitting in a medium-sized garden. It has a crescent shape, so there's two concentric crescents, and it's full of plants that are mostly whites and pale pink and purple flowers. It is also, though it's a moth garden, it is currently alive with bees and other daytime pollinators who also enjoy the garden. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love this time of year when the purples come out. Mm. You know, it's like, I took a bunch of photos of a hike recently of every purpley pink flower on the way, mm-hmm. and just thought I would do something with them, but I think I'm just going to sit and appreciate them. I described you all as sort of like creators of Moth Garden. Do you feel like creators is the right word?
That's a good, interesting question. I think we're creators in a way. I think the project as an idea or as a concept came actually out of research that Lisa was doing, which I'm sure she'll talk about. But in terms of the garden itself, maybe facilitators is a better word?
Yeah.
Co-creators?
Yeah, I was thinking co-creators. I mean, we are responsible for making it happen to start it, but the plants have obviously done a lot of the work. Mm-hmm. I think we joke that plants are the best collaborators because if you don't show up for a few weeks, you come back and they've done so much.
Yeah, that's true. And the rains have been really important collaborators this year, and then moths. The moths are really like the stars. They're the real creators. Like, the project doesn't come alive without them. So. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And then that brings up another question. It's like, why moths? Why not robins or butterflies or bees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as Christina mentioned, the garden originated out of another project that actually didn't really work. So I got a grant from the Culture and Animals Foundation to do research on moths. And also I was trying to photograph them with very low light. So I think a lot of the animals that get sort of care and attention and funding are the ones that align really well with human experiences and senses. So, you know, anything that's big and charismatic or the really colorful bees and butterflies are the things that people tend to put care towards. And I was interested in the things that don't align with us as well. So the things that come out at night, the things that are small, the things that are maybe like appear gray and dull. And so that's why I became really interested in moths. And the idea was to try to meet them in their own sensory world. So for scientific study, I think the common thing is to lure moths with light and then, you know, take really good photos of them, which obviously has reasons behind it, but that's very much bringing a moth into a human sensory world. And I was interested in how we could get to know beings in their sensory world, even if that results in not knowing them as well, or maybe just not knowing them in the same way. So it might just be more a sense that, you know, there's these beings flying around you, the flutter of an ear, a wing by your ear, or the feeling of a moth just skimming over your skin.
Yeah, and I think part of my interest in the project, besides really it being really wanting to work with Lisa, because Lisa's a friend and an artist that I've admired for a long time, so I lured her into working on a project with me, but I have been doing work around pollinators in my artistic practice for a while, and thinking also, thinking about the invisible labor that's like just so essential and important and gives so much generosity to our lives, but how do we create spaces of value or care for those beings as well? So this project felt like also a really beautiful fit with the questions that I was interested in.
I remember sitting just over the hill from where we are now, reading Baptiste Morisot, and he talks about that, the beauty of spring and the sounds and smells and sights, the foods that we eat, being a desert without the pollinators, right? There's nothing. Mm-hmm. Like a desert's too generous of a space without pollinators, because all of this is the work of those beings, you know, going about their lives, doing that invisible labor, spreading seeds or spreading pollen and then enabling seeds. So yeah, I love that y'all feature that and highlight that. It's really good. And again, that repeating pattern, which we can talk about later, of bringing like the invisible to light or the invisible to the fore. What kind of research did y'all do to try and figure out what kind of species to plant here?
Yeah, so I mean, pretty much researching what species are helpful for moths. So we can think of a few things. So obviously the pollen as a food source, but also plants that can host the caterpillars, that are good for cocoons and shelter for moths. So we were just trying to figure out which plants could do those things and how to bring them together.
Yeah, we obviously we did some book research. It's a really great book. I forget the name of right now.
Do you remember the author?
Heather Holmes.
Heather Holmes. That's who I thought you were going to say. Heather
Holmes. So
the blue one.
Is it blue? Pollinators, and I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's
blue. Maybe you can edit.
Yeah. I'll put that in because I like that book.
But yeah, I think that book was an important resource, and I think what Lisa said is a lot of sort of more mainstream or diluted, I would say, like pollinator efforts really are really focused on blooms and blossoms, and like that's my understanding is like that's an important part of what pollinators need, but actually a lot of pollinators live out the time that they're flying is a smaller portion of their life cycle. So yeah. larval plants and shelter and things like that are really, really essential. Ooh. And often get a bit overlooked, because maybe for similar reasons that we're thinking about those fancy blooms and not thinking about the parts that we don't see or attend to of life that are also really important. But we also had conversations with a few ecologists. We spoke with Andaline, who's a really amazing ecologist who's worked a lot with moths, and with Shan. And yeah, they also helped us to think through and fill in sort of some of the pieces that are important in terms of what a space, what are the larger needs in terms of a space for. Yeah. And it's not also just about plants. There's also thinking about, like, I know Andaline talked to us about, like, wetland and how important that is for moth species. And we're lucky here on the place where the garden is that we actually do have not wetland right in the garden, but very close. We have these beautiful sloping hills that slope down into wetlands that are being restored. So
that's
part of the work that we did. And then also just the very slow and gentle observing and learning and seeing. It's been really amazing this summer to see what plants the moths are loving. And we're learning all those things in real time as well.
Yeah, and I think one interesting thing about moths is some moths don't eat when they're in moth form.
Right.
So not all of them are pollinators, which is why it's important to have those other food sources for caterpillars. And I think, you know, if you think of a garden, people often think caterpillars eating your plants is a bad thing, but it's not. Like, if nothing's eating your garden, it's not really alive.
Yeah, exactly. I saw an Instagram post recently saying something like that if nothing is eating your garden, then your garden's probably so out of place in the landscape where it is that something's wrong.
Yeah.
So you should be. And I love that. I love it. I remember someone told me a while ago that when they were young, they used to go out to the apple orchards with their mom, and they were averse at first to eating the apples that have already been partly eaten. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, like, my mom just reminded me that we have to learn how to share.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like, you have to share your apples with whoever is eating them as well.
Yeah.
And so you just cut off those parts if you don't want to eat them, and then eat the rest. I love that.
Yeah. Although I get how it can be.
It's hard.
It's hard and it's nerve-wracking. The pearly ever. There's so much right now. The pearly everlasting is just gorgeous and so lush and beautiful. But the last 2 years in the springs, the pearly of everlasting was getting completely devoured and destroyed, and Lisa and I were like, really, wow, what's going on? These plants that we've like loved and nurtured and cared for, and then we realized it was red admiral. No,
I think it was painted lady.
Oh, painted lady.
Yeah. Caterpillars, and that really shifted how we felt about that. And then also, it's come back like so beautifully and so fully. So. Yeah, getting to know those relationships a little bit more intimately has been really cool.
And isn't that exciting? Like, maybe the pearly everlasting needs that pruning back in a good, strong way a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can develop its roots and other systems, and then be like, okay, now I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like that mutualism that's developed over thousands and thousands of years. You know, it's so cool because you get to sit back and observe and watch and learn from these mutualisms without, like, I mean, I don't want to say that that's not rigorous study, but I guess what I mean is it's not the conventional in a lab. This is the lab, which is better than some closed off building with where even the air is conditioned. But this is fine. This is a beautiful spot. So you said pearly everlasting. I see Monarda fistulosa, the bee balm. I see. Is that Culver's root?
Yeah.
Do you know the scientific name at all? I'm trying to remember the scientific name for some of these plants because I don't know them all.
If you check our website, mothgarden.ca, we have a list of all the plants and their Latin names.
Wow. Yeah. Mothgarden.ca?
Yeah.
Is that the one?
That's
mothgarden.ca?
The one.
Mothgarden.ca?
Yes.
Mothgarden.ca. Sounds good. And then there's some yarrow. And then, do you know who this is?
Yeah, that's a bergamot as well.
Oh, cool.
Wild bergamot. We have some pale purple coneflower. I mean, these are the things that are blooming at the moment.
Yeah.
We have several species of vervain. There's some liatris or blazing star.
Is this a... What's,
blazing yes. star.
Blazing, that's cool.
Milkweed.
It's this beautiful purple plant, sort of, or purple blossoms, but they sort of coil and curl in this long raceme. Yeah, that's beautiful.
There's some Nicotiana over there,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that one smells amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the asters will be coming on and blooming shortly. We have a number of different species of native aster, and then the things that have finished are the lupins, the harebells are just about finished, penstemon.
Indigo, and yeah. The wild indigo.
And then we have this little bed in the center. There's, as Lisa mentioned, the garden is like a crescent moon shape. And in the center, there's a circle of wild strawberries and yarrow that's meant to be a place that one can rest in.
Yeah, and surrounding the garden is a third concentric ring that we planted this year with similar species of plants, but we've also added shrubs, which is one of the things we learned from the ecologists we spoke to about how important shrubs are. So they're teeny tiny now, but eventually that will be a ring of shrubs around the garden.
What's the important part of shrubs? Like, is it overwintering or, well, yeah, what is it?
Yeah, I think there's some aspects of shelter, but also just in terms of supporting the moths in the larval stage, shrubs and trees are really, really important. Like for, we have an oak tree that we haven't planted yet because it feels like a big decision.
Yeah.
Because that will be here for a long, long time. So we're really trying to be intentional about where that goes. But oak, for example, hosts, I think, more insects than any other species. So yeah, the shrubs are really important in that way.
Yeah,
and also provide some shelter, and that was part of the, I know the intention is to have the garden feel a little bit sheltered or safe or enclosed.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, Lisa?
Yep.
Yeah.
Y'all said that you're planting as well to consider other life stages of the moths. And I was wondering if you said you found a painted lady, a butterfly larva, the caterpillar here.
Many.
Have you found other caterpillars or eggs around?
We've seen some cocoons. We haven't been able to ID them, but I've definitely seen some cocoons.
Cool.
And we've seen evidence of plants being eaten, but I don't know if we've seen the culprits.
Yes.
Also, we will be having an event this week with Shan, with the BIPOC Outdoor Gear Library. So Lisa and I we come to this project really interested in moths and pollinators, but we're obviously very amateur in terms of our knowledge and understanding. So we're really excited about, I think that's part of what we'll be doing in that event is looking for caterpillars and cocoons and...
Yeah, in terms of moth ID, we're definitely beginners.
Yeah. It's hard.
We're just starting out.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that in a second, about like a previous conversation that Christina and I have had and how I think that's beautiful. But yeah, I want to keep going a little bit more because there was a question of... Actually, no, let's talk about that now because... The conversation that Christina and I had was, I think, Christina, you were feeling a little bit maybe self-conscious or uncertain because I might have been asking questions about ID and, like, who's coming and who's what. And then you shared that, like, maybe this project seeks to relate in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And can y'all tell me about that? Because I'll explain that my angle often as a naturalist is ID and then go to the books to figure out what the relationships are and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's weird. like you meet someone at a party and then you go search them on Facebook. You know, like that's my approach sometimes, and it's not
and
always.
And not that that doesn't have value. I think there can be a lot of value in that, but I think, you know, when Lisa invited me into this project, I think there's, it's not the focus is to necessarily like ID moths. There's a different way. That maybe I'll let Lisa speak to a little bit more also, because I know it really came out of her research, but a different way of, we're striving for a different way of being with moths and what our relationship with moths can be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's sort of this scientific way of knowing and being with things. So like you said, you see something, you ID it declaratively, you learn about it, and that has value and use. And at the same time, I wonder about all of the things we maybe can't know or don't know. Do we have to wait until we know about them to care about them? Is there a way we can still put care into the world as humans for the things we don't know? And maybe there are things we will never know. Mm. Like, I just want to create a space for that possibility, mm-hmm. that you can still take care of them, mm-hmm. Without knowing them in that very, mm-hmm. bright light of science.
Mm-hmm. And what opens up within us and within our capacity for relationship when there's this invitation to come into moth world. So this summer has been amazing because for the first time, because the garden's a little bit more established now, we've been able to come at night and be with the moths, and we don't even try to ID them because we're coming in a very gentle way. And it's been just so, it's for me, I know it's changed my whole perception of like the night and the world of insects and pollinators, because there's just this really incredible wonder of experiencing moths at night and also just being in the quiet and being in the dark. And it's very different from, I think, the world that we live in our day-to-day lives often, and so coming into that world I think can be a little bit transformative.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that Wendell Berry poem? To go in the dark, yes. With the light is to know the light, to know the dark, go without sight, mm-hmm. and find that the dark too blooms and sings, yeah. and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings.
Yeah, that poem has very different meaning for me now.
Cool, yeah.
Now that I've been in the dark with the moths,
yeah.
without a light. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things we're sort of learning and fostering in Moth Garden is how to bring other senses into experiencing the world. So not that everyone experiences sight in the same way or sight at all, but we live in a world that really privileges sight as the main way of knowing. And we're hoping that Moth Garden invites people to try to hone and experience the senses they don't tend to use, or maybe use them in a different way. So in the dark, just listening or feeling that vibration of wings, just some of those experiences.
I love what you just said, Lisa, about listening. It just reminded me of there's a podcast, which actually you introduced me to, with Robin Wall Kimmerer in the On Being podcast, The Grammar of Animacy, and she talks exactly about that, about how science really privileges sight, and that there are all these other ways of, like, all these other senses and ways of knowing the world, including listen, and that Indigenous knowledge, she talks about how Indigenous knowledge really can be based in listening in a more receptive way. And I know for me, I think that's one of the things Moth Garden has opened up space or capacity for, is for listening with other senses.
When I got to visit the other night, the biggest thing that I came away with was, when you can't see something, the tiny, the infinitely small feels so big. And I came with t-shirts and short shorts on, and these little insects were landing all over me, And when we did shine a flashlight, they're tiny, but they felt so huge. And I was like, what is this massive being crawling up? And I look over and it's like smaller than a freckle. Mm-hmm. And it was, it's amazing how if you turn off that dominant sense, all these other things come out and bloom and blossom into so much more. And the impact is so much greater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It invites you to slow down. Like, slow down your experience. And when you're opening up to attending to what's there in the dark, for me anyway, it's really helped me to slow. And then what slowness opens is this like enormous wonder.
That's cool.
That's my experience.
Yeah.
Well said.
I'm gonna condense two questions in the one. I'll just ask the two questions and y'all can answer. First, does this garden feel like an interspecies devotional? And then the second question was, in the context of your lineages and ancestries, do you know of any traditions which have taken up this kind of creative or devotional act to celebrate and honor the more than human?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I would use the word devotional only because, I don't know, it's a word I use often, but it's an interesting way of thinking about it. I guess, in a way, you could say it is. It's about, you know, we come fairly regularly to the garden, not every day, but, you know, once a week at least, and putting care into the world. Mm-hmm. If that's a form of devotion, then yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's been a very central question for me in my practice around how do we care for other species, how do we care for land, particularly in, you know, context of capitalism and colonialism, that's really based on extracting. What does it mean to try to move outside that and move into a relationship that's more based in care, reciprocity. In terms of your question around like cultural, can't remember exactly.
Lineages and ancestries.
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking a lot about that question, and I don't have a good answer personally, but I do. I was actually thinking about. Gardens in a lot of ways have become the focus of my practice in the last decade, and I do very much come from a lineage where gardens are really, really important in my family, and have always been. I know, like, you know, visiting relatives is always like the first thing you do is you go and you see the garden and you see what's blooming and what's changed. And I know for my recent ancestors that I know of, that like learning about plants and gardening was really, really important. I think in my own lineage, there also are a lot of sort of colonial ideas about what a garden is and should be, that I'm like learning about and trying to shift. But yeah, I think that for me, that sense of like love and wonder and striving to care for something, is very rooted in my experience of my family, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, well said.
Mm-hmm. Where that comes from, I don't know.
I don't know. I often think of those cultural practices or lineages of connection with the land, at least in a European context, have been generally colonized out of us, you know, replaced with Christendom and all that. And I think that the one way to find traces of that, or not the one way to find traces of that is to look into stories and fairy tales and as leftovers. And some of my favorite stories, or one that I've been reading right now, is someone's walking through the world, has just learned the language of animals and hears the cries of the ants under a little shrub that's burning. And so they quickly remove the shrub, enabling the ants to survive, and the ants say thank you, and anytime you need help, we'll be there to help you. And so it just details this very basic narrative of like, if we support the insects, they will support us. And that we're in this reciprocal relationship with them all the time. And I think maybe you're not removing the burning bush, but maybe you're building new alternatives for those other ones and creating different spaces.
Yeah, I was thinking after I answered about the idea of devotion and thinking, well, is it still devotion when it gives so much back? Like, I think we've both had really good experiences working on this garden. It feels really generative and healthy and just nice to be. Like, it is just a nice place to be as well.
It's a magical place to be.
So
this is where we come. If there's, you know, if there's like something sticky in your life or whatever, like Moth Garden always, like, we'll be here and working in the garden and just like chatting or whatever. It really, I think there's a magic here, and it, something about the garden always helps us to like kind of slowly untangle some of those things. Definitely there's a generosity here as well.
Yeah, and thinking of your question about ancestry, I mean, I have mixed ancestry, so I think I don't know how to make a really direct connection between my Mexican grandma and this garden per se, but definitely learned a lot about how to be in the world and move in a careful, thoughtful way from her. She was a really special person, so I definitely feel that in the garden, but I don't know that I could say that there's like a one-to-one sort of species level thing going on, but yeah, a lot of wisdom from that side of the family tree.
How long do you plan on being here and tending this garden, working with this garden space?
Good question.
Yeah, I think from the very beginning we know that gardens are inherently temporary, because gardens are, you know, a collaboration between humans and plants and other species. So at some point, if we step away, then it's no longer a garden, or at least it will slowly turn into something else. So I think what we sort of settled on is we don't have a plan. We're not like, this is 5 years or 10 years. We are going to continue to care for it as long as it feels like that's what we need to do. And that might be 5 years, 10 years, who knows? But we're just kind of like responding to what happens and what the garden does. And then I think we, at some point, if we decide to step away, then we're not just going to abandon it, but rather maybe the plants move somewhere else. Maybe we harvest all the seeds and Moth Garden becomes 10 Moth Gardens that different people take care of. But we know it's not forever.
Yeah, Moth Garden's also in the context of our relationship with Daniel Hegel, who's so graciously hosted us in this beautiful Hermosa Herbals garden space. So I think that's also like a relationship that gets tended, and then that relationship also will be part of what, an ongoing conversation around what this place is or is meant to be, or how to continue to care for it.
As all relationships should be, right? Like, always in conversation, always working. I think of that phrase that we have on the dashboard of the car and a bumper sticker, love is practice. And it's just like, it keeps taking time to build these relationships and keep learning more and adjust to meet the needs. And it's cool that a garden is like that, right? Like, you're always adjusting, like you did with the Pearly Everlasting, like learning and seeing as you go. And then with the planting of the shrubs, seeing, okay, maybe we need to add this extra layer and just like diversifying the environment a little bit more.
And responding, and like, what are appropriate ways of responding to what's happening here with the plants and with the soil and with the land and into the future. I know for me, with a number of my garden projects, it's always a question I'm really sitting deeply with is, okay, it's like you're having a conversation with the land and the garden, and the plants are like, okay, this is what's happening now, and trying to orient to that, and all right, what are appropriate ways for me to respond to this snow? Mm-hmm. It's no simple answer.
No, that's the best part. Yeah.
But there's a lot of meaning, I think, in... yeah. Because a garden is an interesting thing, and there are a lot of different ways of thinking about gardens and gardening, and I like this. As I work more with gardens, I'm coming around to this idea of, like, instead of, you know, mapping something on, like, having this grid or, like, this idea that just gets placed onto something is... How can we garden in a way that's a little bit more like weaving with what's there and what's happening in the soil and the microbes and the plants that are coming and being in conversation? How can garden be a little bit more like a response or a conversation with what's happening instead of just a sort of a top-down planning and making it happen? But that's been a very challenging... It's a challenging thing to orient to, because I think we get told a lot about what gardens are and should be and should look like, and so
I feel similarly that, like, a garden is that conversation, and us taking up that conversation in a good way. Mm-hmm. Thank you all so much for taking the time to answer a bunch of my weird questions and
good question.
And putting this together, because this is beautiful. I know not everybody's gonna, most of the people that listen are in the States, but not everybody's gonna get a chance to see this, but mm-hmm. I will share some photos and some of the photos from the other night as well, mm-hmm. and maybe people can get an idea of what things look like.
Yeah, should we take a moment to describe?
Yeah, keep describing as much as you want, because it is beautiful.
Also, maybe if people are in different growing zones, we encourage them to look up what plants are good for moths in their area, and even if they don't have a moth garden, just to add a few plants that are specifically for nighttime pollinators to their own gardens, that would be lovely.
Yeah. Or spread the seeds. Yeah. Today is very beautiful. It's a little bit of there's quite a breeze. The storm is coming tonight, I think, and the stems of Culver's root, those beautiful, they almost look like spears or tridents or something. They're waving in the wind. They're yellow clusters of flowers. And then the flowers underneath them are a little bit more sheltered, and they're just gently swaying, the beautiful purple bergamot clusters and the white. Ooh, how do you describe that? The pearly everlasting blooms. What is that like?
Looks like pearls.
Like pearls. Perfect.
I think it kind of looks like the foam of a crest of a wave, and especially with the breeze moving through. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And despite there's the wind, there are a lot of bumblebees.
Yeah. Working hard.
On the blossoms today.
And our blazing star looks like Dr. Seuss plants.
Yes. Yeah.
A Dr. Seuss shepherd's crook.
Yes. And in the night, if we came in the night, and what we've been doing is exploring in the night in a few different ways with little headlamps or UV lights, and also take red lights, but also taking some time to just be in the dark, then you would feel the flutter of the moths around you, maybe see some of the iridescence on the blooms.
My favorite photo has definitely been looking at the dog vomit slime mold and then looking at it in light, and then when we used the UV light on it and certain parts were glowing neon green. Mm-hmm. It's like, that was cool. That was very cool.
Yeah. It's so interesting. A lot of animals see more UV than humans do. Like our vision, we see a lot more red than other beings, or generally speaking. And so it's just amazing that other beings might be flying around and seeing that fluorescent slime mold all the time, and we miss it unless we have help.
Yeah. Well, thank you all very much. I really appreciate this.
Thank you.
This is awesome.
Thanks, Byron.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. Big thanks to all the insects, the moss, the bees, all the tiny things that I couldn't name, for being out there creating this project. Thanks to the plants, blooming and blossoming, sprouting and shooting out. Thanks to facilitators, Lisa Hermer and Christina Kingsbury, for making the space. And thanks to Hermosa Herbals for providing the space for them to do that. If you want to learn more about their project, check out mothgarden.ca. If you want to know more about this show, you can always look at www.toknowtheland.com. Email me at toknowtheland@gmail.com. Instagram is @toknowtheland. If you want to support the show, you can always go to toknowtheland.com/donate. And there's ways to set that up there if that helps. That's it. Take care.